Welcome to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete Sunshine 96.7 FM. Join us as we celebrate the sparks that ignite, the events that inspire, and the songwriters that create. With your host, Steve Robb.
If you could combine the DNA of Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie with that of Robert Frost and Kermit the Frog, you would end up with someone very much like my guest, Tom Smith. Now a folk veteran of over 40 years, Tom performs at festivals, coffee houses, schools, and concerts throughout the northeastern United States to audiences large and small and young and old. So, Tom Smith, welcome to Song Creating.
It's a pleasure to join you, Steve.
Well, it's great to have you here. So you and I met at one of the very last open mics before the COVID shutdown. Mm. We were at the back room of the Burn.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember that. It was a Tuesday night. And I sang one of my, I think my only protest song called Vote, because it was getting close to the election. And you complimented me on it later, but I don't know if you remember it or not. I know you've written recently a protest song about George Floyd, which was great and very effective. Do you recall what your very first protest song was?
Oh my goodness! Well, you know, I've got a few years under my belt, so I've strongly influenced by the early Bob Dylan and the folk of the '60s and the civil rights movement, anti-war, and so forth. So I sang a number of them from the Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie variety. But the first one that I wrote, I can't quite remember which would be the first one. I've done a lot. That's not all I do. I love the poetic music as well, but when all of the election and a lot of turmoil and, you know, like you say, George Floyd and so forth, others came out. And that's when I decided, you know, I've never actually put out a record of songs of protest. So that's what it was, 2020, when I did an entire record of songs of social justice in protest.
Yeah. Well, I was more or less referring to the DNA that I mentioned before with Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and their history of that. You are a classic folk singer. Is there a hyphen there anywhere? I'm not sure. It's kind of folk singer. I don't know if you want to describe it a little bit more in a subgenre or anything like that.
Well, you know, folk is one of those things that folk music, folk songs, very, very difficult to define. It's one of those things that I think it was Harry Tuft who said the greatest definition I heard about what a folk song is. And he said, well, just play it for me and I'll tell you if it's a folk song. It's kind of, in other words, you kind of know it when you hear it. And, yeah. You know, and it depends on whether you're talking to the academics who are talking about the, you know, the old ballads that were passed from person to person. Sometimes today, if you play a song using a guitar, then it's a folk song. At least that some people think of it that way. When I describe my little elevator pitch, it's just performing songwriter and singer of old songs. That's the way I describe myself. I love writing songs, and the songs that I do write pay a lot of homage to all of the masters of the past, and especially the traditional folk. In fact, the whole first 25 years of my performing was traditional folk.
And when did those 25 years start?
I grew up in rural northeastern Pennsylvania. And when I was in a child through high school, I would sing I guess what you'd call classic country, because that's what my family sang when we gathered in the living room. But then at 18, when I went to college, I went to Cambridge, and that was 1967. And that's when my eyes really opened up to traditional folk, some of the more classic songwriters, you know, like Tom Rush and Gene Ritchie and Melvina Reynolds, Tom Paxton, Bob Dylan. And then, so I that was in the late 60s. And I did an awful lot of, for a while, I tried being a professional musician rather than use my college degree. And what I did for years was I would go into schools and libraries and I would sing traditional folk songs that related to curriculum. I probably had 300, 400, or 500 songs that I could go into a classroom and they said, yeah, we're studying about, you know, the Cumberland Gap or whatever. And then I could probably do 25, 30 minutes of songs that related to the westward movement through the Cumberland Gap.
And, oh my God.
For me, it got to a point where the whole business part of it got to be really difficult for me to maintain. And so I stopped as a professional musician, and I would play guitar in my living room from time to time, but I didn't even play out in open mics or I didn't do shows.
Well,
until, I'll tell you an interesting story is that when my daughter, my youngest daughter, when she went away to school, my goodness, let's see, 2004, she wanted to learn how to play guitar. So I got her an old guitar that I found actually literally in a trash barrel. But she was in Washington, D.C., and I was in Boston. And she said, well, I'm trying to learn how to play guitar. How do you play this song by Patty Griffin? And so I would make a little movie of it, and I would send her the movie, and she would learn that. And we went back and forth like that with various songs that she loved. Yeah, here's this Joni Mitchell song. I don't understand these chords. And after a while, I said, you know, Mally, you're sounding pretty good. Why don't you go out and find an open mic? And then she said, well, I'll go find an open mic if you find an open mic. And so she challenged me. And I,
as daughters tend to do.
In a wonderful way.
Yes.
So we both decided, oh, I know, I don't know if you've ever heard of Ellen Schmidt, but Ellen Schmidt is a kind of the mistress of the open mic for 60 years now, probably. And she's an old friend of mine. And I said, well, Ellen's doing an open mic on Tuesday. Do you have anything down there? And she found a local coffee house that did. And so, okay, we'll both go Tuesday and we'll compare notes afterwards. So I went out to the Colonial Inn in Concord, and Ellen was doing the open mic then, and we renewed our hello friendship and music friendship that way. And I sang two songs, and the bug bit me, and the bug bit her, and now she's a songwriter and performer as well. And I've been doing this since, what did I say, about 2005 now. I've been very active, both writing and performing.
Wow. Were you writing a lot in those early days, that early period?
No, I probably wrote a total of 3 or 4 songs in my life before the early 2000s.
What caused or what prompted the songwriting part of this? I mean, you said you had 300 to 500 songs.
Yeah,
that's an enormous amount of songs to have to play.
Well, those 300 to 500 songs were songs that were traditional songs.
Yeah,
I didn't write those songs since the early 2000s. I keep a little database of them. I think I probably wrote about maybe 150 songs, I think probably I just needed to do some living and have something to say. I've always wanted to write. I've always sat down to try to write, often when I was in my 20s and 30s. And it, what came out sounded much worse than the traditional songs that I was singing. So I thought, oh, why bother? But then the thing that broke through for me was I was sitting in the house and I got a knock on the door, and it was our neighbor, a young man, probably 16 or 17. And he was selling some, I don't know, was it bread? And I said, Nikki, what's doing here? And he said, yeah, I'm selling this because I'm trying to earn something to pay my brother's legal fees. And I said, what? To make a long story short, his brother had finished a tour in Afghanistan. And he came home and was suffering from PTSD. And the week before, he was in a bar with his best friend. And I don't know, something triggered him. His best friend put his hand on his shoulder, and he snapped and turned around and punched him so hard that he killed him. And
whoa.
This affected me so much that I thought, oh, you know, Nikki, that's terrible. And at that point, I thought, oh, I've got to learn a little more about PTSD and everything. He did go to jail, but he's out now. And I signed up for one of these online discussion groups of people who have PTSD. And I basically just lurked. I didn't contribute because I didn't feel like I had anything to say, but I wanted to hear what these vets said, and not only the vets, but their spouses as well. And I was so moved, I decided to write a song about it. And that was basically my first song of the new Tom Smith era. It was a talking blues, because I'm an old Woody Guthrie style of a guy. And so I thought, well, I'll do a talking blues. So I did it, talking PTSD, and I stuck it on YouTube. I thought, oh, let's just see what happens. And, you know, within a year or so, it's got like 60,000 views and people commenting and sending me emails, you know, saying, oh, thanks, somebody's listening to what's going on in my head. And I was really encouraged that it had some positive effect. It just lit my fire for writing. And so I have continued, you know, songs for social justice, but I've also done things that were more poetic, and I love writing those things. And since that time, have really enjoyed joining songwriting groups and being part of the New England songwriting community, which is, as you know, very rich.
Yeah, and huge and talented. If you hadn't gotten that positive reinforcement, do you think you would have kept writing?
Well, I guess we'll never know. But the when I was going to the open mics, inspired by my daughter, and even as I was singing traditional songs, the companionship and the friendship was very compelling. So, you can, on any night in any open mic in New England, you can find rank amateurs, people who picked up the ukulele last month, and you can find people who are really extremely talented, and in both cases, big applause, lots of friendship, lots of camaraderie, and yeah. that is so appealing. So I'm certain I would have continued, if only for social reasons.
When you wrote that song, was there a certain satisfaction that you had
before
you even got it out?
Just the song itself. It calls to mind a quote that rings in my head frequently from Bob Franke, who's a great New England songwriter. I was talking to him about not this song, but another song. And I said, you know, Bob, this strange is that when I come up with a line that just works perfectly, I start weeping. And he said that, you know, that shows you it's the right one, you know, it's working, and it's that emotion. So, you know, it happens all the time. And it happened like right after I wrote that song, I sang it, and it's a talking blues, which is not pretty, you know, it's a Woody Guthrie, Bob Dylan style talking, classic folk form. It's not pretty, but once I finished kind of working on it and it was taking shape and it was pretty much a song, I sang it and I wept. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you know, it works when it speaks to you like that.
Going back to the first Tom Smith, I want to go back even a little further back to Pennsylvania. I love the idea that your family played music in the living room. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking this is just the classic, you know, Appalachian feel to it. What was it, that kind of scene, guitars and you know, other instruments?
It was Northeast. I grew up in Northeastern Pennsylvania, which is coal country. And we were not very well to do. So entertainment, like going to the movies, would have been a very special thing. So, and it was mostly my father had six sisters and most of them lived just down the road from us. Mm-hmm. And we would go to their house. My Aunt Carrie, my first music teacher, when I was five, taught me how to play the ukulele. And so that was a huge thrill to be able to sit in the living room and play Your Cheating Heart on ukulele with all of my family. You know, it was kind of like, well, this is where I belong. And I can remember it. It was an Arthur Godfrey ukulele, his plastic ukulele with palm trees on it. And there was a box on the neck with buttons that you could push down, kind of like an auto harp. So you can get different chords by pushing buttons on the neck of the instrument. And that was how I learned how to play different chords, was just by pressing the buttons. And so I was probably, five, six, maybe. And Carrie taught me a couple of things on the piano, and my Aunt Nancy would write songs, these, you know, romantic classic country style songs. And it was great. It was great. My dad played harmonica. I didn't know that my dad played guitar. But one day I found under his bed, an old guitar. And, that was my first guitar, because he wasn't playing it at all. And I learned how to play taps on it. And that was my first song I ever learned how to play a guitar. And, but as I say, it really took off once I got into Cambridge and all of my college buddies it was the social scene, you know. Yeah. Every party was basically a sing around. Every wow. party.
I remember I found my dad's ukulele, and it turned out he learned ukulele, clarinet, drums, and piano, none of which he could actually play very well. But there was one point where he and I think I was probably just learning guitar at 9 or 10, and he taught me Darktown Strutter's Ball. And I just, you know, and 5'2", and I mean, those are just two wonderful, wonderful songs. And that was kind of the extent of my my family gatherings, he and I, but that was fun.
You're listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM.
And we're back with Tom Smith. Tom, when you got to Cambridge, that was a hotbed of all kinds of activity, not just musical. Did that, I don't want to go back to the protest and social justice songs again, because I know you write a lot of other things, but at that must have opened your eyes, a kid from, you know, small towns in Pennsylvania, to more than music and the whole, you know, otherworldly things. How did that have also an effect on you? Obviously, it must have, but musically or otherwise?
Well, in every way, because I guess I was the definition of provincial. You know, I grew up in a rural place where basically all of my classmates grew up to either be farmers' wives or took over their parents' farms. And the fact that I left and went to school was unusual. And when I landed in Cambridge, it was kind of like, you know, that scene in The Wizard of Oz where the Dorothy gets it, the house lands and it opens up and everything's in color. That's exactly what I thought. Whoa. And, you know, it was hippies and, you know, it was music, it was demonstrations, it was, oh, 67, you know, the summer of love. It was amazing.
Wow. Now, is your daughter still, is she still active and playing?
Yeah. You can find out about her at malliesmith.com. She's, oh my goodness, she's very prolific. She has a lot of albums that she's put out and recorded, and that she's not a professional. I mean, that's not how she pays her groceries, but I say she's professional quality. And she's living in Edinburgh, Scotland now.
Oh my gosh. Is she performing up in Edinburgh as well?
Yeah. She's done a number of things at the Celtic Connections and other, you know, coffee houses and shows.
So you've been pretty active now for, I guess we're going on about 19, 20 years in the local area here. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Boston has is just a huge music scene, and very, very folk related. I'm thinking as you're talking about Jane Fallon, who you probably know.
Yes.
And it seems like the two of you and you in particular have to be somewhat of historians to write, or maybe a historian isn't the word in your case as much, but you actually, you know, you did the research to write this PTSD song. And I know the research, it wasn't, you didn't do the research because you wanted to write a song. You were drawn to write a song once you learned everything. But there is a value to really understanding what you're about to write about. You know, we all have our own educations in love and you know, whatever trauma that we might want to write about. But something like that. And I'm wondering what else have you kind of researched in that way? That's led you to, whether it's led you to writing a song or not, what else have you looked into?
You know, I think I've mined my own experience. It's basically the way it works. I mean, for example, I wound up getting involved in several discussion groups about white privilege and the experience of Black Americans, and then all kinds of, you know, demonstrations and things like you mentioned, George Floyd and other things. And I wanted to write something, but I knew I couldn't write a first person thing from the point of view of a Black American. That would be an insult, first of all, and it certainly wouldn't ring true. I'm sure I'm a cisgendered white male, you know, and I grew up that way, and I also was struggling with this notion of white privilege because I grew up poor, you know, and I thought, well, you know, I got a degree in college because I worked for it, da-da-da-da-da-da, I don't have white privilege. But the more I talked with folks, the more I, you know, mined my own background there, I realized, yeah, I just by the fact that I have this white skin, I have privilege. You know, I got a loan to buy a house, even though I didn't have a lot of, a lot of money to put down, partly because of my white skin. That's why I have privilege. And so I decided I would write first person account from my own experience. So I wrote a song on that. Liberty and Justice for All is the name of the song. I haven't published it. It's on my website, but I haven't published it otherwise. And as I was writing about white privilege from my point of view, I was using irony in the song. And irony, as a songwriter, you know, can be kind of a tricky thing. It's sometimes it kind of, people don't get that it's ironic and they get upset, you know. But I wanted to put in irony into the song. And I went to a songwriting group that week and I said, here's my new song. And in my songwriting group, all 12 white songwriters patted me on the back and said, that's great. But I had the, thank goodness, I thought about it a little bit. And I recorded it and sent it to a half a dozen Black friends who said that they would give me some feedback. Three of them were songwriters, three of them were educators. And to a person, they said, you can't say this. You know, if I would say something ironic about everything's fine, we're all equal here, you know, they wouldn't necessarily take it as ironic and saying, this is, you know, of course it isn't. And I thought, oh, you mean you can't tell I'm being ironic here? And so it was really important to have that, you know, that's research done, I guess, and to have people to give feedback. And I realize I don't do a lot of co-writing, but I do a lot with songwriting groups where people will criticize or give feedback while the song is in process. And I find that really important. So it changed that song, I think, for the better, and got their tacit approval after I rewrote the thing.
An old man on a stage, his age belies the power of his song. With a voice that may be shaky, he clearly sings of making right from wrong. Because he's old, he is told, time to bring your singing to an end. He replies, as long as I can play my banjo, I will do the best I can. I'll do the best I can. I don't listen to the noise. I wake up and take a stand, put my heart into my voice. Stones are smoothed by grains of sand, so even though I'm just one man, I do the best I can. That Phoebe in the rafters of my front porch doesn't stop to take a rest. She hears that music flowing from her feathered offspring filling up her nest. To and fro, bugs in tow, on a task that never seems to end. And I ask her how she does it, and she tells me, I do the best I can. I do the best I can. I don't listen to the noise. I don't claim to understand. I don't have a choice, but I'll sing in the end. This is where it all began. That's why I do the best I can. Sometimes I count myself among the many who are ready to give up. Perhaps we've started way too late, and the distance is too great to make it up. But step by step, we can get farther from the start than from the end. For the sake of all our children and their children, I'll do the best I can. I'll do the best I can. I won't listen to the noise. I'll wake up and take a stand. Put my heart into my voice. I will get there in the end. I'll sing it once again. I do the best I can. Just do the best you can. Don't listen to the noise. Up, take a stand, put your heart into your voice. You will get there in the end. Every woman, child, and man, do the best you can. We will get there in the end, if together, hand in hand. We do the best we can.
Nowadays, compared to your 60s musical time frame, what do you find is the difference between now and then?
Musically? Well, it's all fashion. You know, like as I was coming up, the fashion was traditional. So you played, you know, who's going to find the next blues song that nobody's heard before from some old scratchy OK record, you know, and that was the treasure. And then, you know, come the 70s and 80s, it was like, you know, the songwriters and, oh my goodness, the folk rock back in those days too, you know, like the Crosby, Stills and Nash, the Byrds, the Youngbloods, the British yes. folk, the Steel Eye Span, the Fairport Convention, you know, they were all kind of merging the traditional folk with the contemporary folk, bringing a contemporary stand. And then you had the, you know, the song poets, the Eric Andersons, the James Taylors, you know, the Joni Mitchells, you know, were really inspirational. You know, then you have though in modern times, current times, I think the songwriters have just sort of notched it up a bit. You know, it's storytelling. I think now there's a lot, at least of the people I'm listening to, there's an awful lot of storytelling. And I love that. They're basically like little mini film shorts, you know, that in 3 minutes you get an entire story.
So let's talk about your song that you presented here, Do the Best I Can, which has a bit of a story in it. I'm guessing this is a little bit autobiographical. You start with your first three words are an old man. So, you know, here we go. I'm looking at Tom here. He's got a, you know, grizzled gray beard and balding head. You know, he's, and as anybody's gathered by going to college in the 60s, you're not a young guy. Tell us a little bit about how this all came about.
This was written about the time of the first climate summit. And I was in my little cabin up in Jaffrey, New Hampshire. And quite frankly, I was feeling very discouraged. You know, there was, yeah, maybe even a little depressed about the lack of progress and the heating of the planet and what are we going to do for my children and their children. And even though the climate summit was making progress, it was, I saw it as being far, far short of where we should be. And at about that time, then there's the political situation, which was, can it be even worse? But it was, you know, really creating a lot of anxiety. So I was feeling the need to kind of encourage myself. And so I was thinking about a couple of things that I wanted a song that would lift me up by singing it. And I wanted to write a song that, without being preachy, would encourage other people to join the struggle. And so I thought about things that were inspiring to me. The first verse, the old man on a stage, I had in mind Pete Seeger, because at the time he was, his voice was really shot. He could hardly sing at all. And yet he'd get, he would be forgetting words and other things, but he still got up on stage and the audience would kind of carry him along. And so I was thinking, you know, that's really inspiring. So that's the old man on a stage. His age belies the power of his song. And, you know, and he says, as long as I can play my banjo, I'll do the best I can. And basically is that's it. You know, all I could do is the best I can. I can't fix it myself, but I'll keep doing the best I can. And that was the hook in the song, I'll do the best I can. And I also was listening a lot to, as I still do, to David Mallet. And I thought, he has a couple of songs where his choruses are not quite choruses because they change. You know, like if you hear the first one, you say, oh, that's a chorus. And the next time it comes up, if you sing the same words, you'll be out of sync because his chorus has changed. And I thought that as I listened to that, I thought that really gives the song forward momentum. You know, even though it would be great to have everybody singing along, when it changes, it kind of your brain pops out. Oh, I've got to listen to this. And it gives it forward momentum. And then, so I thought, oh, let's try that with this song. So that's why the choruses differ as they go through. The second verse is nature. As I was sitting in my cabin, I saw this Phoebe going back and forth to the rafters of my front porch. And I thought, oh my God, you know, all day long, both Phoebes, there are a pair of Phoebes, and the male and the female both do this. They both go back and forth and feed the youngins. And I was feeling like this little piece of nature was also a metaphor for doing the best you can. I'm just going to do the best I can, you know, and he says, she says in her chorus, you know, I don't listen to the noise and I don't claim to understand and I don't have a choice, but I'll just sing. And in the end, this is where it all began. I'll do the best I can, you know, kind of like, you know, I don't really have a choice. All I can do is just keep going. And then I wanted a verse that was a little more on top of that, rather than finding more things that are inspirational. the third verse is something that's a little more of a lesson and introspective, I guess you'd say. You know, sometimes I count myself among the many who are ready to give up. Perhaps we've started way too late and the distance is too great to make it up. And thinking about climate change, you know, maybe we started too late. But step by step, we can get farther from the start than from the end. At least we're, you know, we're making progress. And for the sake of all of our children and their children, I'll do the best I can. So it's, I'm not going to fix it. I can't fix it, but here I am doing the best I can. And this is I'm not telling you do this. I'm saying this is what I've come to settle on. And then I have my, you know, the chorus to follow that. And then I do like a little code chorus at the end and it gently poking at the listener, you know, just do the best you can. Don't listen to the noise. Wake up, take a stand, and put your heart into your voice. You'll get there in the end, every woman, child, and man. Just do the best you can. We'll get there in the end if together, hand in hand, we do the best we can. So this was published right about the time of the 2018 election. And I... gratefully had Lisa Bastoni do a beautiful lyric video of it and you know, shipped it out at all for all of the used it as a fundraiser to raise money for people who were trying to get out the vote.
You know the line I really love in here is stones are smoothed by the grains of sand. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's one of those wonderful metaphors that, mm-hmm. that just, captures everything. And, you know, I love the visual of it. Cause I love sand. I love the beach, you know, so mm-hmm. that catches me. But, this must have been one of those lines you were talking about that makes you smile or makes you cry. That when, I don't know, to me, I find that to be really one of your most brilliant lines in here, because it just mm-hmm. works really
yeah.
nicely.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from. You know, I was thinking at the time of a song Pete used to sing, "Benny Drops Can Turn a Mill." You know, and of course that metaphor is used frequently. And I was thinking, you know, what other metaphor that's like that could I use? And when that came to me, stones are smoothed by grains of sand. So even though I'm just one man, I do the best I can. And I love the multiple rhyme there, and it just rolls through. And like I say, it has forward motion. So this is a song where I think it's important to have that forward momentum.
I like this idea of the forward momentum. And I too, I interviewed somebody, one of our podcasts, I don't recall who, and he said, every chorus really needs to repeat. Mm-hmm. And because people want to sing along with it, or you want to get people to sing along with it. And I said, well, there's certainly logic to that. But I find I do a lot of what you do here, because you have so much you want to say,
mm-hmm.
and why do we have to repeat something when we can, you know, we can keep expressing something more? Mm-hmm. And I guess that's just a matter of opinion. I like the way it does change, because there's just more to say, and the chorus responds, or the chorus refers to the verse that comes before it. Mm-hmm. This song is kind of to me it's both an inspiration and a challenge, you know, to people. There's a fine line between inspiring somebody to do something and challenging somebody to do something, this song kind of does both.
Mm. Well, it's a delicate balance, and the last thing I wanted it to be was basically a lecture. You should do this. You should do this. You should do this. And I think part of the thing that softens that is you're talking about cases from other people who have, you know, like the Pete Seeger verse and the Nature verse that you're not saying you have to be like Pete or you have to be like this sparrow or Phoebe. And then the third verse is very introspective. You know, this is where I'm at here. You know, I'm sometimes ready to give up. And by saying that I'm ready to give up rather than saying, I know you must be ready to give up. No, I'm saying sometimes I'm ready to give up. And then people are naturally drawn into that. And my hope for this song was by that time, as they're drawn into it, they're willing to accept that, you know, the singer is encouraging people to join him to acknowledge that you can't fix it all, but you can take steps. And if we all take steps together, it'll be, you know, on the path to better life.
Did you have your guitar with you as you wrote the words? Did they come together?
Yeah. I find it difficult not to have an instrument in my hands while I'm writing.
It sort of gives you a little structure sometimes in your strumming pattern. But your chord changes are really, I enjoyed them. You know, there's a couple, I wouldn't necessarily call them really curveballs, but it's not a straight G, C, D, E minor song. Mm-hmm. There's more to it than that. As you developed this song, and what prompted that question was, as you were talking about how you wanted this song to be received, you're singing this very gently, as you do. That's you. You know, if you wanted to, you could have vocally made this more of a louder song. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you thought about that or what other things did you, if you can think back to that, you kind of forget all those things that you put aside.
I think it's just a matter of personality. That's my personality. I taught school for many years and my modus operandi has always been invitational, you know, a gentle invitation to participate. And I found that successful teaching strategy. And I think I just naturally fell into that with this song. I am experimenting a little more with being a bit more energetic and forceful, but not necessarily by making it loud. You know, I'm discovering where the range of my voice, the pitch I'm using and the quality of the voice can take on different emotional strategies to better fit the lyric. So, you know, that's what I'm working on these days, is trying to make the music match the emotion of the lyric.
Mm-hmm. Kind of draw from that disciplinarian teacher that you occasionally, mm-hmm. when you had to raise your voice. What age group did you teach?
Most of the time I was teaching 6th through 9th grade.
Oh, wow. Oh, boy. that's a tough age.
I loved them. I loved them.
I was a youth group mentor for a while. The term was mentor. That's the term I used. The title was mentor. And they are, God, I mean, just the range of maturity from that age 11 to age 14 is just extraordinary. And you put all them in a room together and anything can happen.
Yeah. One of the things that I did for my master's thesis in education was I did a survey of the music that people use with children and that children sing from infant through adolescence. And I mapped out the different qualities of those songs and how those corresponded with, you know, Freudian and Ericksonian and Piaget as far as the thinking of cognitive development. So So as children are able to do different things, they're interested in different kinds of songs, just like they're interested in different kinds of, you know, physical activities and other kinds of activities. And so I think that also helped. You know, I did a children's record last year, mostly because my son had twins and we couldn't visit them because of COVID. And so I decided, well, for Christmas, I'll make an album for them. And I think the songs that I write for younger audiences kind of definitely is informed by that study.
So is this published somewhere?
Yeah, it's called Apples and Cheese is the album. It's on my, you can find it at my Bandcamp store.
No, I meant your master's thesis.
My master's thesis. It's deep in the sub-basement at Lesley University, I think.
Okay. That seems fascinating. I'd be curious to see what the middle school songs were that the adolescents were listening to at that time. Mm. Oh, man. Yeah.
Well, how about, have you ever heard of I'm My Own Grandpa?
I have not.
Well, it's I'm My Own Grandpa is a song about a person who, through a strange series of happenings, becomes his own grandfather. You know, he gets married to somebody who is, you know, it is possible. And that was a song that I remember working with early adolescents, because their minds could talk about, you know, different relationships. And when we would sing that in school, I would actually have them get out and map out all the different relationships to prove that a person could become their own grandfather.
Oh my gosh, that's great. Now, that's not one of your songs though, right?
No.
Or is it?
Okay. No, that's a kind of a classic, what is it, maybe 1920s or 30s?
Boy, I don't know. I got a feeling that song would be banned in school these days. It's just too suggestive. Well, Tom, this was really fun. I enjoyed it. Great talking to you. You can be found at tomsmithmusic.com, right?
Indeed.
And I don't even think I have to spell that. I mean, we all know how to spell Tom Smith.
Right.
No H in Tom, T-O-M. S-M-I-T-H, we'll spell it anyway. tomsmithmusic.com, all kinds of great stuff. And you are... you are very active in the songwriting community in the area here. I think, do you recall Nashville Songwriters or one of those groups that you?
I do participate in the Nashville Songwriters Association. And I have a number of different songwriting groups I participate in. Mostly it's friends in a living room, though.
Well, thank you. This was great. I really enjoyed hearing everything. It's a wonderful song. I'm glad we had to talk about this one.
Thank you. And if folks are listening to this before it gets into March, I have a couple of sweet gigs in March. I'm at the Linden Tree Coffee House the first weekend in March with Chris Levancher and Kim Moberg. And then later in March at the Jabberwocky Coffee House in Brockton, Mass.
Awesome. All right. So Tom Smith, thank you very much. We'll take care.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete. If you like what you hear, you can find Song Creating on your favorite podcast app or at songcreating.com. To check out my own music, go to steverobb.com. And until next time, keep a song in your head and music in your heart. Thanks for listening.